Welcome to the Baraza, a show that aims to talk about Africa, the African story, and the African experience. Each week, we take on various topics which, throughout the course of the season, will not only educate, inform, and also entertain. I'm your host, Benjamin Walgwe, joined in studio, finally back in studio, my co-host, Patrick Wendolo. Pat, welcome back.
Hi there. Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Yeah,
it's been a minute.
Yes, it has been quite a minute.
life-changing experiences. Yeah, more content.
yeah. Have you been though? Yeah. From last year.
More responsibilities at work, traveling more often, so that has been a challenge, and most of the places we travel to are places without any network infrastructure, you know, so it's been a challenge, you know, out there in the boondos, traversing, so I hardly have time, but I will make time, you know, we have to make time for everything. And and here we are. I said, no, we have to do this. We started this journey and we should complete it.
100%.
Yeah, so you tell me, not that I, maybe for the sake of our audience, yes. Maybe they'll be asking themselves why you've also been away for so long.
I was actually unwell for some time. So yeah, and yeah, fortunately, I'm back in the building. You know, yeah.
It's nice to have you. You know, these experiences really, you know, help you get some direction in terms of what's really important in life and just appreciating every moment. And I really appreciate having you back in good health. And, you know, every day is a gift.
100%.
Yeah, we live it to the fullest.
Oh, yeah. And you live and you learn, you know.
Yeah, yes, yes.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Oh.
Yeah.
So lots have been happening in our beautiful continent of Africa. What's so notable to you, you know, that's, you know, the events that have occurred ever since we spoke?
Well, you know, Africa, as I always say, mixed emotions, man. There's a lot of there's a lot of good and there's a lot of disappointments, you know.
Yeah, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, and it's the extremes of both ends. It's really good and then it's really ugly, you know.
Yes, yeah. Extremities.
Exactly, you know. One of the things that, but one thing I can say is, to be very honest, Africa is waking up, you know.
Okay.
I don't think we are no longer where we were, you know, before.
Definitely.
Really opened their eyes into the exploitation of Africa.
Yeah.
You know? Because to some degree right now, it's in some parts of Africa, it's literally in your face. You know, with the more people are getting educated, the more exposed people are getting, the more information is being shared, the more
we
break our cultural barriers and our borders, the more we are communicating with each other, and we are realizing that, you know, a lot of the issues that we face in our specific you find us similar in other countries, you know, regardless of language barrier,
Yes, indeed.
and culture, etc. You find issues are the same, especially when you look at exploitation. No matter what country you go to in Africa, there is some level of exploitation going on, you know?
Indeed so, yes.
Yeah, especially when it comes to our natural resources. Yeah. So, you know, I'm glad that when you look around, it's not getting easier for the exploitation to continue. It's getting harder. And when you have to put in a lot of effort to cover something, it's also costing you something. So at some point, is it going to be as lucrative as, you know, the person perceives it to be? Because all loopholes over a period of time will be closed. And the generation of that's coming up, yeah, they're vicious men. They're hungry and they're vicious.
Very true.
They get it.
Yes, I concur with that completely, especially notably for me, the digital transformation, you know, post-COVID. Digital transformation in Africa, which has accelerated digital economies, you know, within Africa. But still, of course, definitely it's still a young concept, but it accelerated the acceptance and adoption of e-commerce and the internet and sharing of information. And I like what you said, because the generations that are coming up, you know, are more conscious and of what's been happening, and are researching. They're hungry for information, and information is readily available to them, as compared to our, you know, our generation when we were starting.
Exactly.
It's completely different. You know, it's a different experience altogether. So they are starting, and they ask a lot of questions, and that is a good thing. And they question almost everything. They question government, and that also reduces the ability of governments to exploit and just pump out propaganda. But you know, so they ask questions and they punch holes at everything that politicians bring before them. So yes. Digital transformation has made information more readily available. The only thing probably Africa needs to invest in is infrastructure for connectivity. Which will definitely, you know, close the gap between us and the outside world. Yeah.
But don't you think we need some level of inner peace for us to even achieve that? For us,
yes, in
of the mindset, because our borders are fictitious. These are just smoke and mirrors, you know. As we always, take a 45-minute flight, and then all of a sudden your currency changes, and you're holding a bag of.
Is it post Berlin conference borders?
Exactly. You know. Yeah,
so we didn't make them. It was just actually a portioning of the African cake for plunder that those borders came to be.
Since we didn't make them, can we break them?
Yes, we can. And actually, on talking about that, the developments in terms of trade, we have come up with an African Continental Free Trade Area, AFCFTA. And this was launched in 2021, January last year. But it's coming into effect, and it's supposed to be implemented all across Africa so that we have a free trade area.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is to to encourage intra-African trade, which is very low, surprisingly low, yet we have all the resources, and you know, then we wouldn't have a situation whereby people are starving at one corner of Africa, and yet there are other areas in Africa or countries in Africa that have proper harvests. And so there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to trade with each other and work towards food security. Yeah. So this is a good initiative, because it's on the ugly side, and on the saddening side, Africa only accounts for 2.19% of global exports. Yeah. So, you know, we had a network problem there. I was talking about debt colonization by the Chinese. And that's the new strategy that is being used in Africa. You know, the Chinese are like, you know, 1 point something billion, and they need to feed their population.
Yeah.
And of course, like, you remember when we were talking the last time in regards to fertile land and food production, they're looking towards Africa. And a lot of African countries are falling into the trap of giving away their fertile land and thereby threatening food security in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But the Chinese are buying off land. If they're not buying off, they're leasing off land from Africa to grow food and take back to their country to feed their people.
Yep. And I think we talked about this, economic warfare.
Yes. Yes.
We talked about it, we described it, you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so that is a worrying trend that I can say is notable this year. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. And then going back to the ugly side of Africa, wars and civil wars. And what comes up to note this year is Ethiopia. Ethiopia enjoyed quite a long stretch of relative peace, until the Tigray issue of secession popped up again. That's northern Ethiopia, right?
Yeah.
Where the People's Liberation Front wants cessation, are fighting for cessation for the longest time, but they've been operating more or less kind of independently up there, isn't it?
Yeah, but don't you think there's someone stirring up to what end, you know, at the end of the day?
Yeah, exactly.
So do you think there's a puppeteer behind that?
Definitely. There's always a puppeteer.
Mm-hmm.
There is always a puppeteer, especially when you're dealing with Africa. You'll always find some underlying issues and maneuvers and all that. Just for example, and I bring to your attention the war in Central African Republic. Mm-hmm. It's been going on for decades now.
Yeah,
And we know that basically what's driving this war is conflict minerals. Minerals.
Uh-huh. Now that you talk, because if you realize everything that you touched on is basically, at the end of the day, natural resource, regardless of how you do it, because you talked of food security. Now, I'll give you an example as you're going into the minerals. Okay.
Yes.
Because one very important mineral that also Africa has is oil, which
exactly
most of it has been discovered in the 20th century.
Yes.
Moving forward, right? 20th century moving forward. I think most of Africa's oil, although there's some countries like Nigeria who had oil for a minute, but then again, there's the exploitation of that. So you have, for example, recently, the Nigerian Navy, they arrested a Norwegian ship that was stealing crude oil, you know, in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a lot of black market crude oil being sold. Yeah.
And they basically entered without any form of authorization or clearance. And the Nigerian Navy had to arrest, you know, the ship. You know.
Wow.
Yeah, and wow. Of course, if you're to go through even the owners, you know, the ship is owned by Hunter Tankers, you know, from Norway, you know.
Wow.
And they're basically outrightly trying to lift crude oil in Nigeria. They have their own issues in Europe, you know, because as Europe stands right now, it's trouble, no matter how you look at it. Food, their food security is, they're about to be in panic.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at oil and gas prices, it's crazy, skyrocketing, you know. And everything, of course, is quote-unquote blamed on Russia, Ukraine, which is also, in my opinion, artificial.
Yes.
So you have some of these daring acts outright, which tells you, again, how stupid they kind of think we are in terms of you can outrightly, you know, people function back in the day where you just come dock, you know, you just set up your troller or your tanker and whatever, and you just start doing what you're doing. The Chinese used to just troll Lake Victoria, you know?
Yeah, trolling, yes.
And that also affects the environment, because as you're trolling, you're affecting so many things. The algae that's growing in there, you're just scooping everything.
Plus the
so you're scooping the wood and what you're looking for, and so it's a whole mess, you know. And then again, you cannot completely blame the West, because as I always say, no one can come to your home without you opening.
Yeah, we're enablers to a large extent.
Yeah, so they only dangle the carrot and then they watch and they say, okay, now you finish the whole plan and we execute fantastically. You know, so that's an example of Nigeria. If we move to Zimbabwe, what have they been doing of late? What, let me say, in the month of August. So they they have withdrawn, okay?
Yeah.
From the IMF. This is the International Monetary Fund.
Wow. They have.
Yeah, they've basically there's a special fund drawing rights, okay?
Yes.
That the IMF has, and Zimbabwe have basically withdrawn $311 million. That is okay.
Oh my God! Wow.
Yeah, and this money, basically, they want to use it. First of all, most of it they used it for COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know how that goes.
Yep. Believe me, so I do.
I'm sure there are a couple of COVID millionaires or billionaires, it doesn't matter, depending on what currency you're using.
Yes, indeed.
Yep. And
but the West is not immune to that, though.
And it's crazy because they have to pay it back.
Exactly. The same deal with the China loans and grants.
Mm-hmm.
Same deal. You know, they'll give it to you. Oh, you want you how much do you want? Oh, I'll give you anything. But there's a cap.
Yeah, but Pat, the saddest thing is the same money that you're using for COVID, you're giving it back. Because you don't have the rights to manufacture a vaccine, which the West is not going to give you.
Exactly.
So, really, you're taking a loan from the IMF, who is in itself funded by the same people who probably, you know, own all this other stuff. And
And then you pay them, and you're giving it back to them with interest.
Yeah, so...
Million. But you haven't manufactured any product. There is no money that is actually circulating in that economy. Yeah, and saying that we built, you know, a factory to manufacture masks, to manufacture COVID drugs that we can export so that we earn foreign exchange, foreign currency. Nothing. We're just paying these guys back for taking the loan for a period of time. And to add insult to injury, we are buying the product from them.
Exactly. And if I give you the breakdown, $71 million, okay? Please note they took 311.
Yes.
$71 million out of that money went to COVID vaccines, okay?
Oh my God.
And then the vaccine rollout program took another $6 million. Okay. This I guess is citizen education and all that, and blah blah blah. Okay.
Sensitization and all that. Yeah.
Material, etc. Then
you have bed occupancy and blah blah.
Exactly. Then you have procurement of COVID-19 related medical testing equipment. This is another $10 million.
Oh. Man, yeah. It's just sad. You know, when you just look at that, it just makes you sad because...
Yep.
It's like, Benjamin, I'm giving you money to buy bananas from me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Yep. And I charge you interest on that money.
Man,
What have I just done to you? I'm just impoverishing you because I've removed money from your pocket to pay me interest.
Imagine.
But next time you'll have to come back to me to buy more bananas. You don't have the capacity to supply bananas on your own because you haven't grown any banana.
Imagine.
And I say, I'm helping you, dude. Don't worry about it.
How have you helped me?
I haven't at all.
Yep.
I'm creating an environment of dependency, which the West has always wanted, because the minute that we become self-sufficient and we gain self-sufficiency, then they become irrelevant, and they won't allow that. And that is why they got rid of Gaddafi and that ideology of having a common market, which now is being revisited, and a common currency, a currency that would definitely be, if not the world's strongest, because we, in terms of bullion, we are set in Africa.
Oh, yeah. So, but then who controls again? What exactly is happening?
That's another problem again, because value chain, we look at the value chain also.
Mm-hmm.
Value addition, logistics, refrigeration, even if you are exporting fresh produce, have we invested in the value chain? And where are we as Africa within? Are we players in the value chain? Shipping?
We're just producers. Know? We just produce and we give it. Then we buy it back.
Yes.
We are producers and the same consumers.
Yeah, and then we buy it back. Imagine, and we buy it back 10 times the price. I mean, I produce coffee, I farm, and then export it. It's exported as raw material, and it comes back as Nescafe, blended and all that, and packaged. And I buy 10 times the same price. But we are not ready to make strong brands within Africa and invest in value addition. What does value addition mean? You have to invest in industry. So that you produce finished products, you know?
So, but there's one industry, Pat. There's one industry that is very, very huge in Africa. And this is the secondhand market industry. Okay? Now, when you have the secondhand market industry, okay?
Oh, that's a different ballgame altogether.
Do you understand how many people this sector employs?
Millions. All over Africa, millions.
Exactly. But
at what expense?
And I'm talking about to the level of you have the wholesalers, you have the distributors, you have the retailers, okay? There's their own supply chain on that other side.
Yeah, when it comes supply to chain, yes, material. Indeed.
Okay? Now, if we move towards a direction of manufacturing our own, how much work do we have to put into? Because, number one, we don't appreciate our own. So if you wear your traditional attire, someone would prefer to wear, who knows,
you know that the international brand Gucci,
Armani,
Dolce and Gabbana, or Armani, yes,
because yours is inferior. So now what happens when that gets enough traction and more people start to manufacture locally? You know, local industries get to start thriving. So what happens to that market? Because that's another market that may suffer a huge blow when that
happens. Look at it this way. Benjamin, the definitely change is not devoid of pain and discomfort, so to speak. So in my view, when you're moving from, yes, there is a secondhand clothing industry, and when now we make an affirmative decision to start manufacturing locally and creating strong African clothing brands, so to speak, but we have invested heavily on producing quality fabric, and some of our traditional, quality fabrics are really good quality, like in Benin or Benin, as you may, and these are fabrics that are very pricey. But once we move them and we upgrade them to the latest trends, then you see there's the multiplier effect, because you employ people then around that industry that you've created. Then you will need banks, because people, the staff that are working there need to bank their money. So they need insurance. And so it expands business. So the multiplier effect of that, and of course, a supply chain comes up with that. Exports. So we're earning, foreign exchange now. More or less, let me compare it to, say, the flower industry, whereby purely, luckily, it doesn't need much value addition. Probably the only thing that you need to invest in is supply chain, refrigeration and all that, and packaging.
You have to look, because the flower industry will fall under agriculture. Yes. Now under agriculture, here you have inputs and you have machinery. These are farming inputs.
Exactly.
And who is controlling the farm inputs?
In terms unfortunately, of and whatever. It's the West.
Okay, so we don't have that, and the tax imposed on the purchase of this machinery or equipment is crazy. So we cannot compete.
Yeah, in terms of pricing, yes. At once, the comparative cost of production, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really have a comparative cost advantage in producing some products. But I believe that we can start from somewhere. If we are to look towards other countries, say, you look at China in terms of machinery, or you look at India, how did India do their thing? How did they achieve the level that they've achieved to be one of the emerging tigers, as they're called, in terms of industry, from the cottage industries level to where they are today in terms of manufacturing strong brands like Godrej, Mahindra? They started somewhere.
But their labor, you gotta understand, their labor is crazy cheap. Those guys are many.
Yes, very true.
They're like
very
true. Dude, they're like popcorn. They are many. They are many.
I just picked a packet of popcorn in the microwave, and definitely the birth rate is very high in India. Yeah, I understand. In terms of factors of production, Asian countries have a huge advantage. China also, in terms of the cost of labor, very, very cheap. That's why America can't compete with them. But Benjamin, you must remember that we should focus on what we have comparative cost advantage in manufacturing. We don't have to get into all sectors, but we identify the sectors which we have comparative cost advantage, whereby we have the inputs and the final product will be able to compete, favorably in the international market. But look at it this way: if we have a common trade area like what they're working on right now, this African Continental Free Trade Area, then we can decide that, okay, we're going to open a factory of, say, chocolate factory in Ghana, but we've agreed as Africa. So we are looking at which countries have comparative cost advantage in producing certain products. We have coffee, so it makes sense for us, maybe probably as African Union, to come together and say, now Kenya, you'll be producing your coffee, we'll be taking our coffee and for processing and everything and packaging to Kenya, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you getting the aspect I'm trying to drive at? So now, within our, because we already have a free trade area, so there are no trade tariff barriers within Africa for that intra-African trade, but we decide, okay, we're establishing a factory in Kenya for coffee and tea, because it's cheaper to manufacture there rather than in a different country. Oh, we're going to go to South Africa. We're going to be processing raw diamonds and gold and whatever, finishing them, you know, cutting the diamonds there instead of probably in Kenya. We're going to be processing oil in Nigeria and maybe Sudan. Yes, and we establish our industries there for processing crude oil.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible. It's doable. Yes, I understand the challenge. But how? Okay, for example, but how did India, for example, beat the challenge of machinery? You know, during their industrialization process, from the cottage industries and being able to come up with such, you know, beautiful machines. It was trial and error, yes. Initially, their machines weren't good quality, but that was the same process China went through in terms of their industrialization.
But the Chinese got help, though. They got help from the Russians, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
They got to realize that maintaining their hard stance on communism, it's difficult. It won't cut it in this day and age. It's hard to.
It's hard, but it's
not communism, and you still want to be capitalist? Hey, that's a China. China is a hybrid.
Yeah, they have a hybrid. Too. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. But look at India. What would you say?
Mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah, they're more capitalist, but they've still managed to achieve, you know, excellence. Look at Malaysia. Look at Singapore.
Singapore.
It's doable. It's doable.
And those were third world, by the way.
Strategic.
Those were third world countries.
Yeah. Yeah, but we have to be strategic. Let them call us third world or whatever, but we have to be strategic. If at all we are to play in the international arena, favorably, of course, then we also have the issue of trade agreements and unfavorable trade tariffs and all that, you know, that have been imposed on African products. Those are the things that probably we need to work on, because what is the access to international markets have we been given? Have we been given access for finished products, or have we been given access just for raw products, you know, unprocessed?
Mm.
Those are the kind of discussions, but I believe that charity begins at home. I do not understand why there should be people starving in one corner of Africa and there's a bumper harvest in the other, and we can't trade with each other and say that, okay, we're going to have strategic food reserves, and this is the amount that we shall be putting aside, and we agree upon it. Any country that is hit by hunger, we shall be with, you know, drawing from that strategic food reserve as Africa, not that there's someone out there dictating to us. They said, no, you guys, your land is fertile, you produce enough maize for yourselves, Uganda, you produce enough bananas, you produce this is the way we're going to handle it. Yeah, we're going to make banana chips, we're going to do what, value addition, blah, blah, we're going to find a way to store that you know, that produce, so that it doesn't get, you know, we've got to be a bit innovative. But if, you know, and also apart from that, then we also need to invest in farm inputs if we are looking at agribusiness, because I must say agribusiness is the backbone of Africa. Apart from minerals, so we have to transform that so that the multiplier effect is processing. We are moving to the next level of the supply chain. Yeah, mm-hmm. Producing finished product, just like Ghana. You know, the president, the Ghanaian president, said, Switzerland, no, you guys have been taking us for a ride for long enough. No one has done anything about it. I'm doing it. Now. I'm not selling you any more of our cocoa beans."
Mm.
Yeah, okay, it's a noble thing, but you've got to have a game plan of, okay, then I'm going to process, I already have an industry set up, I have a brand that we're working on, or rather brands, and you have a market strategy or a go-to-market strategy. How are you going to achieve that same level of revenue? Because your complaint was, yes, your farmers are being underpaid. That's a given. Yeah, but what's your solution? Just like what Robert Mugabe said, he calls there as imperialists and all that, and, you know, and you send the white people away. Yes, fine. But have you educated people with the requisite skills to manage the industries or the companies that have been left behind?
Mm.
You know? Those are the questions. For example, okay, I'll give you another example. Nelson Mandela. Everyone is excited. Yes, you know, we have a black president in South Africa. Fine. But what's your investment in terms of educating the black locals within that period of time that Nelson Mandela was in office? Because black people were denied education for a long time during apartheid. So have you invested in that so that these people can take up key positions within companies and industry, and, you know, that's in innovation and technology and research? Has that happened? No, you find that most of the businesses are still being controlled by the white people, the big business, the diamond industry. That, you know, are you getting what I'm talking about? Yeah. So I see our leadership lacks is a game plan. And then there's also that aspect of interference and from the West and whatever, because that really pulls, you know, if we're, that self-sufficiency is what they always will fight if we are able to cut our own diamonds, if we are able to process our own coffee, where does that lead them? Now we shall be price dictators. Yeah? We'll be telling them, no, if you're not buying it at our price, then please go elsewhere. And they cannot envision such a situation. But Muammar Gaddafi had envisioned that we will be market dictator. No, what? Determinants. And that didn't augur well with the West, because they can't see how that would work. They need us. It's that, and then it's a multiplicity of problems, Benjamin, because you look at it and then you have puppet presidents. Who are serving the interests of the West. You look at it, how Mobutu went and killed Patrice. Who was financing Mobutu? It was the Americans when he was a rebel. Then later on, who comes in? Mobutu grows a big head, yada, yada. And then they finance who again? Kabila Senior. So it's all interest. So when you have such leadership, do you think they'll be they have that Pan-African mindset? They don't. So you're dealing with such a multiplicity. Yes, the locals know what they need to do, or rather we know what to do, but they've been held by the nuts, so to speak, by the West. So we put you in there in government to serve our interests, and the minute that you deviate from the plan, then we just get rid of you and bring in another one. Will allow us to plunder your resources.
That's true.
So they have used poverty as a weapon, because when you keep Africans poor, then they can fall for anything. You can rob them.
Mm-hmm.
You can make them do anything for a shilling.
A hungry man.
Yeah. Yeah, but Mali says it very, very well. So it's a multifaceted issue with so many sides that we need to, as Africa, come together and decide where we starting from and how are we going to kill this thing? Because it needs a multifaceted approach at the same time, all at the same time. But then, those leaders that have that Pan-African mindset, are they there currently in leadership in countries in Africa with that vision for Africa?
Yeah, but then that
Gaddafi had. How many Gaddafis do we have? Okay, we have Julius Malema in South Africa, who's being fought vehemently because definitely he's a nightmare to them.
but that's my guy, though. Julius is crazy.
So you see, our Pan-Africanists are killed, and that's the reality.
That's the price, you know. At the end of the day, you know, when you choose a path, the ultimate price sometimes is death. Because you have to be 100% aware of the kind of people you're affecting. And which begs me to ask, you know, to ask myself sometimes.
Yeah.
Does culture also play a part in hindering progress? Because in Africa, culture, you know, culture sometimes, my opinion, when I look across it, we have a mixture of monarchies or other kingdoms, and then we have the executive. And sometimes, you have situations where those two clash, or now it becomes a feast in terms of, let's just eat everything for ourselves.
Yes, that happens.
You know, so you have in Uganda, for example, you have the Kabaka, right? And the Kabakas, he still has a say in terms of population that he controls, in terms of the
access
that they have, in terms of their land. So they have a say somehow. And yeah, you know, one can become a pain in the other's back, or they can work cohesively together.
For example, I would one that I that complements, if in Nigeria's case, you know, they still have that, but it kind of works. But the traditional kings and chiefs also still have a lot of influence within at the grassroots level. Yes, and are very heavily engaged in politics. Though they still have an executive, it works for them. But areas like Uganda, there was a time with Museveni, the current president, had told the Kabaka that he and threatened him that he should only engage in issues, local issues, but should not be actively engaged in politics. So I don't know, you know, that those clashes happen. Then we go to places like Lesotho. Or is it Lesotho? I don't know if I pronounce it right. It's more heavily leaned towards the monarchy systems. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to have been working for them for a while.
Eswatini. Now,
yeah, with King Swati.
Mm-hmm.
And his topless wives. I don't know. Anyway, it seems to be working for him.
Culture, Pat. I don't think, sometimes when let me not be too harsh on them, because how we perceive also their ceremonies, we kind of sometimes misread or misunderstand what the ceremony is about.
We do.
We think it's about the guy is just parading naked women and whatever. I think if you go deep into the culture and how they do their stuff, you won't criticize.
Yes.
Their own symbolism. And they do their own thing, you know?
And what makes ours wrong? I mean, who created the standards?
Well,
because it used to work for us. And it wasn't that we were perverts or whatever, people had control. You know, we were basically walking, you know, naked and taking in the sun with our melanin, you know, and it worked for us. And we were, you know, keeping ourselves away from disease.
Mm-hmm. But the kings got affected. Call a spade a spade. The kings got corrupted, and they're the ones who sold the rest out.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. Allow me to read a letter from King Leopold II of Belgium. He wrote this letter.
Leopold
to Belgium.
Any of our sessions, man. Leopold.
Sorry?
I'm saying, I've noticed Leopold never misses.
he made a huge impact on Africa. Yes, he did.
As much as he's related too much in history. He has a small segment, but it's a very nasty one, you know?
Yeah, he should be at the same level as, he should be discussed at the same level as Hitler, because he killed more Africans than Hitler. You know, okay, we're not saying that we're trying to lessen the Holocaust or anything, but I mean, he killed over 16 million Africans.
Which is colossal.
Yes, by any standards.
Yep.
So here it is. He writes a letter to the Belgian Christian missionaries that were being sent to the Congo at that time. This was 1883. Yeah. And these Christian missionaries would eventually spearhead the Belgian colonization of the Congo. So he, and it reads, Reverends, fathers, and dear compatriots, the task that is given to fulfill is very delicate and requires much tact. You will go certainly to evangelize, but your evangelization must inspire above all Belgium interests. Your principal objective in our mission in the Congo is never to teach the N-word to know God. This they know already. Note that he says, this they know already. They speak and submit to a Mungu, one Nzambi, one Zakomba, and what else I don't know. They know that to kill, to sleep with someone else's wife, to lie and to insult is bad. Have courage to admit it. You are not going to teach them what they already know. Your essential role is to facilitate the task of administrators and industrials, which means you will go to interpret the gospel in the way it will be the best to protect your interests in that part of the world. For these things, you have to keep watch on disinteresting our savages, quote unquote, from the richness that is plenty in their ground. To avoid that, avoid that, they get interested in it and make you murderous. So, competition and dream one day to overthrow you. Yeah? So, your knowledge of the gospel will allow you to find texts ordering and encouraging your followers to love poverty. For example, happy are the poor because they will inherit the heaven, and it is very difficult for the rich to enter the kingdom of God. End of quote. You have to detach them from them and make them disrespect everything which gives courage to affront us. I make reference to their mystic system and their war fetish, war protection, which they pretend not to want to abandon. And you must do everything in your power to make it disappear. Wow. I continue. Your action will be directed essentially to younger ones, for they won't revolt when the recommendation of the priest is contradictory to their parents' teachings. The children have to learn to obey what the missionary recommends. Who is the father of their soul? You must singularly insist on their total submission and obedience. Avoid developing the spirit in the schools. Teach students to read and not to reason. Oh my God, that's our education system. There it goes. There. Dear patriots, are some of the principles that you must apply. You will find many other books which will be given to you at the end of this conference. Evangelize the N-word so that they stay forever in submission to the white colonialists, so they never revolt against the restraints they are undergoing. Recite every single day. Happy are those that are weeping, because the kingdom of God is for them. Oh my God. Did you just hear that?
Wow. Wow. Happy are the poor.
Yeah, you know.
So you
always try, wish so for
poverty is something that you become comfortable with, because you know at the end of it all, you shall.
Because yes, God. You shall inherit the kingdom of God.
You shall inherit the kingdom of God.
Yeah, so you do not have to be ambitious. No, do not strive for excellence or riches. You know, do not invest your riches on earth, where the moth shall eat it up. There's a saying like that in the Bible. There's a verse that says, but invest your riches in heaven.
Mm.
Controversial as it may be, but this was authenticated as a letter from King Leopold II of Belgium.
Basically, what you're saying is that for you, where you stand, you're pro culture.
Definitely. Or I'm still going through that journey, because I was born into Christianity. I didn't apply, but as now you grow older and you can make your own decisions and you become more conscious of things that are happening and why you do things, and you start questioning, why am I the way I am? Why do I worship the way I do worship? And what were we before then? You start, and the more I do my research and discover about what we were and how we worshiped and about spirituality, yeah, I'm changing the way I think of things, but I'm still at crossroads. I must be very honest, because I was brought up into Christianity.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but I subscribe to a superior being, which most religions do. I feel that religion is more or less like climbing a mountain, but from different sides, because we have Buddhism. All of them believe in a superior being.
Yeah.
But why should we be forced to abandon who we believe, what we believe, to cross over and believe what you believe? But yet we all believe in a superior being.
Yeah, but now, Pat, the problem is, we can decide that. Let us go back to our culture, okay?
Yes.
Let us reset. But in the trying to reset, you still have to recognize that the culture, and as I said, the kings and the kingdoms and the chiefdoms and the whatever, they have been corrupted by the executive, okay? Which means,
yes, indeed,
that everything is about the money, okay?
Yes, and capitalism.
Let me open it up a bit with an example, okay?
Yes. Yep.
Now, this is pretty recent.
Uh-huh.
I pick from one of the countries with a pretty rich cultural base, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Of how they operate, how they their belief systems and etc. And one of them is South Africa, okay?
Yes.
Now, recently, there's a King Zulu, okay?
Yes.
And he's just been crowned the king of the Zulu kingdom, okay?
Huh?
Basically home of Shaka.
Shaka Zulu.
Yeah, KwaZulu Natal, where they come from, right?
Yeah, yes.
And he's just been crowned king of the Zulu nation.
Yes.
The Zulu nation is pretty huge. It's pretty huge. You know?
Is it?
If you look at their history, the Zulu nation is pretty huge. The Zulu kingdom stretched, it didn't just, it was not just in South Africa.
Ah, it was also in Zimbabwe?
Yeah, all the way up to Tanzania. Because
What?
in
Okay.
Tanzania, you still have there's still the indigenous people who speak in the click sounds, which means the language, it was open. There were no barriers again. So you cannot say Africa,
Yes, indeed.
Uganda, Kenya. Guys were just walking, grooving, So yeah, and you have some people with click sounds in Tanzania. Now,
Interesting.
King Isizulu, basically controls the kind of power he wields in South Africa. Is he controls over 11 million Zulus. 11 million Zulu. Okay? Which makes up a fifth of the South African population. If you look at his coronation, okay, crazy. And it's there. Like you can actually watch his coronation on YouTube. It's crazy. The
It
ceremony, and what he became a symbol of. Imagine if you had 11 million people behind you. Even politically,
So that the
that gives you
kind of influence would be
crazy,
deadly.
crazy political mileage. Okay,
Yes.
yeah, and of course, in Africa, we also have Game of Thrones. Within that whole process, it was. It's not an easy process because then again, you have to realize that. Mr. Zulu comes from is the firstborn son to the third wife.
Oh, to the third wife. Okay.
Yes, to the third wife
Oh, okay.
of Goodwill. Who was the father?
Interesting.
It's out of this world. And the kind of money that they control in terms of allocation by the government, okay?
Yes.
You have basically stuff like he earns about 100,000, is it 100,000? 100,000 rand a month. Now, if you convert to Kenya shillings, okay, that's not a really crazy amount, but you have to look in terms of government allocation. Okay, they get about 66 million rand, and that amount of money, that allocation, 66 million.
Yes.
Rand times what? How much is the rand in Kenya?
Should be like
10 bob, 10
ten
shillings?
bob. Yeah, let's put it at 10 shillings. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what? 660 million shillings?
Yes, indeed, sir. Approximately, yes.
Okay, so that's 660 million shillings. And this money, first of all, is not meant to go direct to the king's pockets. Okay? But
Yes.
it is to be used for the Queen's allowances, vehicle repairs, maintenance of the six palaces that they have, salaries for support, among other things. Okay? And this is basically what his father, that was Goodwill Zwelithini, the former king. He he's inherited all that. Now, you tell me how many starving South Africans there are. $660 million.
It's
That's
mind-boggling.
$6 million. About $6 million
Yes.
for Queen's allowances, vehicle repairs, maintenance of six palaces. For who? This guy is
Those
not
are some of
to promote, traditional language to be spoken in schools.
when the approach basically does not make sense at all, because within the context of that kind of a system in this century, and you do such things, it just doesn't make sense, because that's all money going into what? Recurrent expenditure, yeah? To pay salaries and stuff and allowances and all that. But how much is going into poverty alleviation or industry or production? But on the other hand, when you look at it, there's industrialization going on, and there's De Beers cutting diamonds on the other side, and they're making serious revenue. So to give out 66 million for you to just chill.
Ceremonial.
Yeah, you relax. You're comfortable with that?
Yep.
Okay. Then you won't disturb us, right? Fine. Then let's continue the plunder.
Yep. And you can imagine. Imagine all these ceremonies happening. Where is the money coming from? Not his pocket.
No, never.
The king of the Zulus. And
yes,
even the his coronation, right?
Yes.
The dates could not even be set well, because they had to find the availability and agree on the availability of Ramaphosa. That is the president of South Africa, who was already, they already gave the letter that he's to be crowned king, okay? And there's drama around the family. There's the first wife who believes the son should be king, and there's this whole hullabaloo around the king, and They're trying to find the availability of Ramaphosa, King Mswati.
Yeah.
Because King Mswati, again, is his uncle. And then King Letsi of Lesotho. That's the guy you're talking about.
You're not serious.
Yeah. So once those guys are available, then they can press play into his coronation.
But you know what? Benjamin, I was just for a minute there. I was reflecting on that against the British monarchy, and how they structure their administration, and how they are able to effect change and development. Do they? Okay, in your view, where do they depart from in terms of system of government?
First of all, Pat, the king should be the protector of the people. Okay?
Yes.
He should not be there to monetize his role.
Exactly.
Supposed to be like the watchdog over the government. But now, if the two are playing ball together, that's why I was saying the two are playing ball. Because as long as you're not causing a ruckus and you're not making noise, okay, then the executive is going to play with you, hence the packs that they're getting. These guys,
yeah,
it's crazy. If I'm to tell you how what they control, you know,
yeah,
unbelievable. The royal trust, okay, of the king's royal trust manages almost 3 million hectares. That's about 7.4 million acres.
What? That's crazy.
Exactly. Now, what kind of land is that? That's under the king's trust. how many people can you hold in there?
What?
How many families can you feed? How many people are landless? Like, they don't have land. They're living on the streets. One
Several.
One guy has 7 million 7.4 million acres.
I think that is the highest level of vanity.
Yeah,
but this was a deliberate attempt. Rather, this was deliberately done just to quiet them, because the system knows, the executive knows that if these people are well structured and organized, and they have a proper system of governance, and they have a plan of action of how they're going to empower their people and everything, it will become a problem.
Yep.
And they start demanding for what they, it, you know, it will become a separate center of power.
Yep.
Then they can even arm themselves. Then they have the ability of effecting coups and, you know, such things. So they know the potential of these guys. So they would rather make the billions and just, you know, give them a few breadcrumbs to keep them happy. But in effect, creating a generation of lazy people who are not really ready to work for and sweat.
Because imagine Patrick, the amount of change that he himself as king can bring.
He can.
Not only,
it's just a matter of a proclamation
to the Zulus. I mean, in South Africa, because if you control a fifth of the population, that means you can now affect policy. And you can,
exactly,
bring in things that actually are beneficial to the population.
Very true. But if you look,
counting your palaces and counting your chests of coins, and both, it's ridiculous. So,
but you see,
so talking about culture, I will always ask.
Yes.
Is culture headed in the right direction, or is there something we should do also? Because we can say, Africa, we need to go back to the culture. Is the culture there to go back to? Is the culture there to go back to? If you turn back, the same guy that you're running away from in parliament or in the executive, this guy is the same guy, but just dressed in different regalia.
Yeah, but you see, this is diluted culture, and if you go back to the Zulu nation, the days of Shaka, King Shaka, these guys were organized. They had a system of governance that was organized. They knew who needed to work the fields, who was and you know what kind of food reserves we need to keep aside. It was a proper system of governance, not what has been diluted in modern day South Africa, just to keep the Zulu nation quiet, because of they are cognizant of their history and their ability. In case they become organized, they will be a force to reckon with. So you dilute the culture, you erode the culture, and you skew the culture, but you leave tidbits of something that they can relate to. Yes, it's the same thing. Like now, when we go into religion and the Zulu nation, if we go back in history, the Zulus used to call themselves the people of the heavens. Yeah, and they believed in a supernatural being called Unkulunkulu, who is supposed to have sprung out of a bed of reeds and then created the world. The human beings were believed to have an umzimba, yes, I think I pronounced it, body, and an idlozi, spirit. In addition, this is in Lizio, heart or emotion, but we're talking about spirit, body, spirit, and, you know, basically it shows you how spiritual we were, and we are not very far from Christianity. If you read, it's almost the same thing we're talking about, mind, body, and soul. Mm-hmm. But how does our religion and culture affect how we do things? Because from African tradition, spirituality also informed art, for example. Yeah?
Mm.
It informed so many other things. Through spirituality, you had the hieroglyphics, yeah, in Egypt,
mm.
which informed their beliefs. That's why you have like images of men with animal heads. But it was a story. It was a documentation of history, culture. And through that hieroglyphics, some of them, you could even see the system of governance of that period of time.
Mm.
That is why Egypt is the birthplace of astrology and many other academic spheres, you know.
And the hieroglyphics basically was because you had to remember by vision. It was more of a visual thing, you know? And I think it's easier to remember visually than written or...
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. You know, because the way we would pass information was through stories, through drawings, and etc. You know?
Yeah, that was our way, yes.
Mm.
So, it's...
Yeah.
So you know that became our library. Mm. So and unfortunately we abandoned our forms of governance and administration within the African societies.
Mm.
Because which was definitely, it was, you know, because administration was basically a mixture of also our spiritual and cultural beliefs, which informed how we operated in terms of systems of governance. Because even if you look at like the Maasai and the, is it the age group system?
Yeah.
And rite of passage and everyone had assigned responsibilities, and the elders, they had sittings whereby they discussed governance, how things were going to be done. The women knew their roles, the children had their own roles. So there was a system, but we just abandoned them, and rather most of it was deleted deliberately. Because if you go back to what King Leopold had told the missionaries to accomplish, then it was a complete dilution of what our cultural beliefs, to weaken us, because they had realized how strong our culture made us. Mm. And they had to weaken us to be able to colonize us.
Mm.
Yeah? Mm. Because like now, sorry, but I'll just be very fast if you allow me. Because there was a follow-up letter from King Leopold after that, whereby he says, and I quote, "Convert always the blacks by using the whip. Keep their women in 9 months of submission to work freely for us. Force them to pay you in sign of recognition, goats, chicken, or eggs every time you visit their villages, and make sure that the N-word never become rich. Sing every day that it's impossible for the rich to enter heaven. Make them pay tax each week at Sunday Mass. Use the money supposed for the poor to build flourishing business centers. Institute a confessional system which allows you to be good detectives, denouncing any black that has a different consciousness, contrary to that of the decision maker. teach the N-word, to forget their heroes, and to adore only ours. Never present a chair to a black that comes to visit you. Do not give him more than one cigarette. Never invite him for dinner, even if he gives you a chicken every time you arrive at his house.
But,
are you listening to this?
Yeah, my question is, did you have a link to Leopold's communication director? Because how are you getting conversations, man? Dude, you've put him on blast.
These are letters he wrote, and you know they were found later on. The Christian missionary journey in Africa was exposed to the world by Mr. Mukwani Bukoko, born in Congo in 1915.
Yeah.
Yeah. And was working in the Congo and bought a secondhand Bible from a Belgian priest who forgot the speech in the Bible.
Oh my God, damn.
So when going back to what we were just talking about in terms of governance and everything, this was deliberate. It's sad, but that is where the brainwashing and as a Christian currently, that was my default status because that I was born into a Christian home. It makes me sad when I read these two letters.
I know.
Because, yes, now when I think of it and see that in almost in every village and every corner of Africa, you'll find a church that's been built by the members of the community. But within those same communities, you will not find the same effort in building schools.
That's true.
But then you go a step further. What they're teaching in school, as King Leopold said, is not to make you think.
No, it's not.
So the curriculum is teaching you a history that they themselves have created for the purpose and agenda that they want to pursue and towards the predetermined objectives that they have.
The curriculum just makes you a fantastic worker and a very disciplined worker. Because if you look at the conveyor belt, oh my God, if you look at how it works,
yeah,
it's crazy.
Remember the line that goes, teach the N-words to forget their heroes and adore only ours.
Yeah, exactly.
So there it is. Therein lies the problem of our education system.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been told, don't educate these guys to think. Yes. Just churn out robot.
Yep.
Yeah?
Mm.
So with that, then you produce graduates. Graduates who you want to churn out to be able to change the trajectory of Africa to self-sufficiency. Are you understanding that multiplier effect?
Yep.
So, are we producing thinkers? Are our curriculums producing Pan-Africanists? No.
Yep.
No.
That's why these days just cramming.
Yes.
Cram your papers and that's it. Move on.
Yeah. Because what is nationalism? What are we teaching? But when you look at countries like China, patriotism, you know, they start teaching the children from a very young age because they know the power of media. They know the power. If they don't teach, if they don't give the citizens a direction, then definitely they're left to the whims of the world, right?
Mm.
These countries know that, and they know that it's kind of programming, by the way.
It
but
is.
It's building culture because Africa historically, they used to start teaching the children at a very early age through stories, and they the kids started getting involved very early in hunting and whatever. And this is business, you see, because the men are hunters. They would go definitely start barter trade and all that. So we were actually teaching our children, but unlike today, where you're not even bringing your child in to your business at an early stage to learn your trade or whatever, but Indians do it.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, you see, when you go to an Indian shop, you find his five-year-old there and he's teaching him how to give back change.
Yep.
But so for us and with our cultural background, cultural and spiritual, because from this letter, it seems that religion was used to pacify us. Rather, that's what comes up.
Yep.
So yes, now...
They had to break what was existing.
Yes. We've become more religious in terms of Christianity than the Christians themselves, like Nigeria's become more spiritual than any other country. I mean, but at what expense? And we've abandoned our own traditions. And it's not that we didn't believe in God. We believed in God. We just worshipped in a different way. But our form of worship was strong. And our form of worship did not kill our self-esteem and tell us that there's a kagai who flies up in the sky who will sort you out later on when you're dead.
Yeah.
Are you getting it? I know some anyone, Christians might differ, but these are the questions that I keep asking myself, Benjamin, because I'm torn in between. Because the more I learn about our spirituality and our deleted culture, it begs a lot of questions. And you hear you've heard about that story of Egypt and the way Christianity apparently borrowed the Trinity.
Yeah.
The Father, the Mother, and the Son. That is in Egyptology.
Yeah, I think that one we shall have to tackle now spirituality on it.
Spirituality is wide, and I think we need a full session for this.
Yeah, in terms of spirituality in Africa. Yes. Because it's pretty wide. It's not the way, you know, the West has Jesus, you know.
Yeah, because in Africa,
we have
deities, God exactly. was it polytheistic, or what word would you use? Vast, because every African society had its own gods and deities. So exactly. It's so wide, huh?
Exactly. So we can actually look into what different regions in Africa, what they believed in, and how they went about their life. You know, so East Africa, West Africa, South Africa.
Yes, that would be
Central Africa. You know, we can actually look into that, because that's pretty wide. You know, and
I concur.
And that being said, you know, I think as usual, you know, time flies so quick. You know, you blink, and all of a sudden we are out of time. You know, but I think, yeah, that was an interesting session. Anything you'd like to add in conclusion?
Well, all I'd like to say is that it's been a pleasure again, and we can only grow. And for our audience, thank you for being good listeners and being there. And we'll continue to strive to bring out more content, to learn from each other, to educate each other, to stimulate your thinking and to towards the quest of self-discovery.
Mm.
And and talk about African issues from the aspect of where do we go from here? How can Africa achieve its greatness? Remove the veil from our eyes, from the years and decades of indoctrination. Can we find ourselves as Africa?
Yep.
Yep.
Well, damn, that's well said. I beg not to add anything.
No, the last word is always yours, Benjamin.
No.
You gotta leave us with the proverb.
No. Yes, of course, I will have to dig in my bag for something that people can ponder over, you know, for the coming week. But I
think in terms
of a conclusion, I think you said it well. You put it well. You said it well. And for me, I think I'll just say thanks to the listeners for joining us this week on the Baraza after a long hiatus. You can catch all our episodes on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or via RSS. So you'll never miss the show. And while you're at it, if you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating. Simply tell a friend about the show. That would help us out too. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And as Pat said, I always leave you with
yes.
And for this week, something to ponder over.
Uh-huh.
We'll leave you with: your perception of me is a reflection of you. My reaction to you is an awareness of me.
Wow.
Have a great week.